Okay, welcome everyone to this year's Brian Berry Memorial Lecture. My name is Lea Uppi. I'm a professor of political theory in the government department here at the LSE, and I am delighted to introduce this year's lecture for the Brian Berry Lecture, Professor Elizabeth Anderson, who is one of the world's leading moral and political philosophers. Professor Anderson is John Dewey Distinguished University Professor of Philosophy and Women's Studies at the University of Michigan, where she taught since 1987. She is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and has written extensively on democratic theory, equality, racial integration, the ethical limits of markets, theories of value and rational choice, the philosophies of John Stuart Mill and John Dewey, social epistemology, feminist epistemology, and the philosophy of science. I will not go through the whole list of publications and achievements. I will only mention some. Her first book, Value in Ethics and Economics, was published by Harvard University Press in 1993. Her book, The Imperative of Integration, published by Princeton University Press in 2010, touches on the moral issue of racial segregation and integration beyond affirmative action in the United States, and won the American Philosophical Association 2011 Joseph Gittler Award for an outstanding contribution in the field of philosophy of one or more of the social sciences. Her latest book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It, was published by Princeton University Press in 2017 and takes issue with the arbitrary nature of free markets and the power held by employers over their dependents. This seems to have earned Elizabeth the qualification of a philosopher on the warpath. This is a quote from the Times Higher Education review of the book. And I don't know if the person in whose honor we hold this lecture, Brian Berry, ever met Elizabeth. I discovered that they didn't. But if anyone in this room, you, Brian, ever met him, you would immediately recognize that the qualification philosopher on a warpath is very fitting for him and applies very well to him. And so even if they didn't meet in real life, they would have met somewhere on the virtual trenches. So just to give you an example, Brian Berry called Nozick's defense of free markets in Anarchy, State, and Utopia a joke, which Nozick himself, he said, was unlikely to see, but which, thanks to the direction given to public policy by Nixon and Ford and their Supreme Court, this is a quote, the American people had an increasing opportunity to enjoy the joke personally. End of quote. So as you can see, Brian's interest and contribution to democratic theory, discussions around the moral limits of markets, rational choice, clearly overlap closely with Elizabeth Anderson's one, and the topic of tonight's lecture is clearly also in some ways continuing the class war, I guess, that Brian Berry started in The Critique of Anarchy, State, and Utopia. The title of the lecture is The Great Reversal, How Neoliberalism Turned the Economic Aspirations of Liberalism Upside Down. And so I will suspect this will either be a continuation and an exposure of the joke that Brian Berry talked about in his review of Nozick, or it will tell us more about the tragedy behind the joke. But before we hear Elizabeth Anderson on it, let me remind you to turn your mobile phones to silent. And if you want to tweet about the event, the hashtag is Berry Lecture. Very lecture hashtag. Floor is yours, Elizabeth. Thank you.
So it's a tremendous pleasure to be able to address you today, and a great honor to be doing this in the name of Brian Berry. I'm going to start by introducing you to some data. Here you can see, this is United States economic data. You can see here that since 1950, steady increase in productivity in the United States, but starting in the mid-70s, the compensation of hourly workers has been essentially stagnant. So this implies that that widening gap in between productivity and income has been taken by capital owners and to a certain extent by extremely highly compensated executives and other very highly paid individuals. You might think that's just American trends, but in fact, you can see here in all of the advanced economies, the labor share of income has been declining over time. What could account for this? It's not a mystery. Since the mid-1970s, economic policies have been steadily changing to favor capital interests over the interests of workers. And I'll just give you a few examples of such policies. So one thing is that intellectual property protections have been strengthening worldwide. You can see here in the United States, they've been going steadily up since about 1830. Because of various global trade agreements, American standards of higher and higher protections for intellectual property have been spread globally as well. Here you can see again, starting from the United States, a map that illustrates the increasing monopolization, or actually this would be increasing monopsony in labor markets. So all of the red areas and the orange areas on this map show places where there are very few employers in any given industry, and hence they hold effective monopsony power, which has enabled them to steadily depress wages in these areas. It's really only in the green spots, the great metropolitan areas of America, that you see serious competition for labor. And it's no accident that it's precisely in those places where you do observe increasing wages in America. This is all due to an explicit change in policy to radically reduce the enforcement of antitrust laws in the United States, and that was a turn of events that took place in the 1980s. This graph shows increasing financialization of multiple economies, advanced economies, leading up to the financial crisis of 2008. Across these rich states, all kinds of financial deregulation enabled bankers, shadow bankers, and providers of financial services to take an ever larger share of the GDP. After the financial crisis of 2008, we all know what happened. The banks and the creditors got bailed out, and the debtors did not. They sunk under much tougher indebtedness. In the United States, there was a major bankruptcy reform that made it almost impossible for students to get out from underneath college debt. And indeed, most debtors are under a much more severe regime than 20 years ago. And in the EU, too, of course, debtor countries are also suffering under severe discipline, Greece being a notorious example. Global trade deals have also led to a system in which the mobility of capital has been much greater than the mobility of labor. That tends to lead both to financial crises and to superior bargaining power of capital owners over workers. In the United States, there's been a steady decline in the enforcement of workers' rights. Consequent steady decline in the percent of workers who actually enjoy the representation of a labor union. Now there's only 6% of workers in the private sector in the United States who have any union representation at all, down from a peak of a little bit more than a third. Across the rich countries, taxes on capital have been cut. Sweden, the great social democratic state, abolished its inheritance tax. Okay, Congress recently tried to do so, didn't quite manage, but radically cut corporate income taxes. So taxes on capital have also been declining in the rich countries. We also see a trend notable both in the United States and in the UK, but in other rich countries as well, of the outsourcing of government services to private for-profit providers. And that, of course, also expands the amount of income that's collected by capital owners, because the typical consequence of outsourcing is the private owners depress the wages of the workers so they can take a bigger share of the revenue pie. What could possibly justify all of these policies? And I've only named a subset. There are many more policies that could be named, all in the same direction of increasing the capital share of income relative to labor. Well, what rationalized it is neoliberalism, okay? A set of ideological justifications for these policies that purport to restore what's known as classical liberalism, that is, liberalism at its origins. So these policies include the idea of free markets, property rights, freedom of contract, holding up efficiency as a major criterion for the success of economic policy, incentives, and famously the idea of shareholder capitalism, the idea that corporations' fundamental, primary, and leading goal is to maximize profits and not pay attention to the consequences of such profit maximization for workers or the general public. Supposedly they'll be taken care of in the course of corporations maximizing their profits. Given that neoliberal policies claim to simply be restoring the insights of so-called classical liberals, it pays for us to go back and do a little historical investigation and consider what classical liberals actually believed. In order to do so, we have to identify individuals who are clearly understood to belong to this group known as classical liberals. Three obvious examples would be John Locke, Adam Smith, the Marquis de Condorcet. And then, as a very late representative of classical liberalism, John Stuart Mill. And then, on the American side, less well known, but of immense consequence for the development of liberalism in the United States, we have Tom Paine at the top, great American revolutionary, and Abraham Lincoln, not so much a thinker, but an incredibly important implementer of a certain set of liberal ideas about the relationship between capital and labor. So we need to ask ourselves, what did these figures actually say about the relationship between capital and labor? These quotes ought to be familiar. God gave the world in common to the use of the industrious, and labor was his title to it. Labor, the source of property rights, titles. And as justice gives every man a title, that is a property right, to the products of his honest industry, so charity gives every man a title, that is a property right, to so much out of another's plenty as will keep him from extreme want. Classic statements by John Locke. Or we could take these famous claims. The property which every man has in his own labor, as it is the original foundation of all other property, so it is the most sacred and inviolable. Sounds sort of like Locke, doesn't it? And when state regulation is in favor of the workmen, it is always just and equitable, a clear endorsement of state regulation in favor of workers. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations. Or we could take this. Labor is prior to and independent of capital. In fact, capital is the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Hence, labor is the superior, greatly the superior, of capital. That one probably is not so familiar to you. You think maybe Marx said it? No, actually, it wasn't Marx. It was Abe Lincoln. That was part of his stump speech for the presidential election of 1860. Now let's think back and consider that far from being wholehearted defenders of property rights drawn from capital, property rights as they existed at the time, I think it is more proper to consider the classical liberals as initially launching a wholesale assault on property rights as they existed at the time. Famously, of course, the classical liberals opposed monopoly. Keep in mind that monopolies at the time were charters issued by the state. They were indeed a form of property right. And liberals, such as Adam Smith, said they were illegitimate forms of property. They also criticized the inheritance laws at the time, the laws for inheriting property. Adam Smith famously argued against the laws of primogeniture and entail because they unwisely and unjustly locked up ownership of nearly all the land in England in a handful of aristocratic dynasties. Tom Paine was a great advocate of an estate tax. He argued that estate taxes should be levied so as to provide universal social insurance, to provide for old age, disability, orphanage, and so forth. Paine was the originator of the first practically feasible scheme for universal social insurance ever conceived in the world. Condorcet was the originator of the very idea of social insurance. Of course, liberals were also opposed to slavery, arguing that it is manifestly illegitimate to steal an individual's property in their labor, and that contracts into slavery are illegitimate and should not be recognized. And that's a uniform view. Locke, Smith, Mill, Condorcet, they're all on the same page about that. And indeed, time and again, when you read the text, the classical liberal text closely, you will find that liberals actually went out of their way to defend labor. So it wasn't just slavery that they opposed. They opposed all forms of unfree labor. This includes not just slavery, but serfdom, peonage, indentured servitude, and apprenticeship. I draw your attention especially to apprenticeship. Smith had a war against apprenticeship, that is to say, workers in training who are not paid for their labor, a system that still exists today with unpaid internships. Smith would definitely have disapproved. Smith, following Locke, agreed that property rights are founded on labor. Smith and Locke together were the originators of the labor theory of value. It's anything Marx invented. He was simply carrying on a classical liberal tradition. Smith, famously in The Wealth of Nations, argued in favor of high wages. Indeed, high and rising wages. Furthermore, especially on the American scene, through Tom Paine and Abraham Lincoln, the ultimate ideal of the classical liberal view was that workers should be self-employed. In the American scene, this was mostly to be realized through individual proprietorships. So Lincoln famously opened up the territories of the United States and gave away free land so that Americans could become yeoman farmers. By the time we get to the middle of the 19th century, we have figures like John Stuart Mill who recognizes that the individual family enterprise could not compete with the big factories. And so Mill's version of universal self-employment would be through workers' cooperatives, where the workers would simultaneously own and work the capital of a rather larger scale enterprise. Here's Lincoln again. He said free labor, he's articulating in his campaign speech what free labor means. And he's explicitly denying in his campaign speech that free labor means wage labor. To the contrary, free labor argues that as the author of Man makes every individual with one head and one pair of hands, it was probably intended that that particular head should direct and control that particular pair of hands. Right? No bosses. Free labor means you are your own boss. Every worker, their own boss. And as I mentioned before, both Condorcet and Paine, great innovators of social insurance to provide especially for individuals who, for one reason or another, are unable to work, say, due to very young age or old age, disability, and so forth. What happened to classical liberalism? What happened was the 19th century Industrial Revolution. My argument is that in the 19th century, the meaning and import of liberal ideals became reversed. And this was largely due to the fact that the Industrial Revolution radically increased the scale of enterprises and created a dramatic division between managers and workers. So in a way, the world of the classical liberals imagined that the ideal free market society would deliver the bulk of its benefits to the most efficient unit of production, which was assumed to be the individual proprietor who works his own capital. Okay? Something like the yeoman farmer. The self-employed worker may have temporary hired help, but in Lincoln's vision, the typical young man would only have to work for a wage for a few years, by which time, with high wages, he would be able to save enough to buy all of the capital he needs to set himself up as a self-employed worker. And then he would temporarily employ a few people who would in turn eventually achieve self-employment. But with the rising scale of enterprises brought about by the technologies of the Industrial Revolution, instead what happened is that ideal, that vision of the individual worker working his own capital split up into at least three groups. Workers now, for the most part, worked for wage and had a boss or manager over them. You had an underclass of precariously employed or unemployed or desperately poor, sometimes disabled people. And then you had capital owners. And it was really capital owners during the Industrial Revolution who redeployed the classical liberal ideals now to favor capital interests rather than the interests of labor. Another thing that happened during the Industrial Revolution was the rise of what I call total institutions. Famously, Jeremy Bentham invented the panopticon, his plan for a prison where, according to Foucault, and quite accurately, individuals would internalize discipline under the all-seeing eye of a kind of big brother, What is less well understood was that Bentham's panopticon model was used as a model not just for the prison, but for practically every domain in which the poor and the working classes were supposed to be operating. So here we have a great quote from Isaac Kramnik, talking about liberals really now moving more into the 19th century. While liberals preached independence, freedom, and autonomy in polity and market, they preached order, routine, and subordination in factory, school, poorhouse, and prison. The model, the panopticon model, was the same in all of these domains. So we can credit Bentham in particular for turning the classical liberal idea of the work ethic, which originally was designed to exalt workers to a higher status. You find Bentham turning that work ethic against the seriously impoverished, especially the underclass precariat, who had only an uneven attachment to the labor market because of rising unemployment, business cycles, and so forth. So here we have Jeremy Bentham as he exists today in a box, nicely stuffed with a beautiful head. I've been told this is not far away. Okay, so I'm going to introduce you to a text. This is an immensely historically significant text, which is also extraordinarily difficult to find. It is not in Bentham's collected works. It took me a couple of days of research to dig it up in the immense University of Michigan library, which is pretty comprehensive. Nevertheless, it's of immense importance. I think it's been buried in intellectual history because it is so embarrassing. The title of the work is Pauper Management Improved by Means of the Panopticon Principle. Okay, he's arguing, and this is incredibly important. I think, as far as I can tell from my investigations, here is the original source of the idea that public services ought to be outsourced to private, for-profit providers. This is exactly what Bentham argued in 1812. The poorhouses should be privatized. Okay, get the state out of it. The poor and disabled should be confined. In fact, he argued that the for-profit operators of the poorhouses should be empowered to basically look around for vagrants on the streets and other people without visible means of support, kidnap them, and confine them to a panopticon-based poorhouse, literally imprison them, strip them of all of their civil rights, and force them to work without pay until they pay off the costs of their own support. He also suggested that paupers could be leased out at below market rates to private employers, with the panopticon owner taking a massive cut of their wages. Bentham was so enthusiastic about this plan that he projected that they could make 200 to 300% profit rates off the labor of imprisoned poor people. Now, you might think there's a little contradiction here, since if they're working until they pay off the cost of support, how could that possibly generate 200 to 300% profit rates? It looks like they have to work off 2 to 3 times the cost of their support before they are let free. Thomas Malthus is also an absolutely pivotal figure, structuring 19th century moral and political thinking. And again, Malthus is an absolutely pivotal figure for turning the idea of the work ethic, originally in classical liberalism, used to exalt workers to a higher status, now used against the welfare state, which classical liberals such as Paine and Condorcet vigorously argued needed to exist in the form of universal social insurance. Malthus notoriously argued that even the very stinting poor law regime of England ought ultimately to be abolished. How did that happen? Well, in fact, I think you can find in Malthus every single element of the contemporary conservative critique of the welfare state. Malthus invented it all. So he preached individual responsibility. What are those poor people doing? They have to get up off their duffs and work. He invented the idea of a culture of poverty, the idea that the provision of welfare to people will make them lazy and licentious, having too many babies they can't support. The welfare state then supplies perverse incentives for people to be idle and vicious, to drink and gamble and so forth. He originated the idea, well, maybe not originated, it's a little bit too strong, but he stressed the idea that people who are dependent on state welfare should be stigmatized in order to deter people from taking up welfare benefits. And quite critically, this is extremely important, he wanted to make his attacks on the welfare state, such as it existed at the time, extremely unpopular among the stably employed working and middle classes. And so he argued that the undeserving poor were a burden on the deserving middle classes because they had to pay taxes for the support of the poor. Fifthly, we can take a look at the rise of racism in the 19th century here. I'm quoting from a much later work, but looking back, you can see a fundamental rejection of Enlightenment commitments to equality, which lasted from about the 1770s to the very early 19th century, and its replacement by an extremely harsh racism, which of course was the basis of empire among all the imperialist states. So here I have a quote from Hastings Rashtal, already pretty late. We're looking at 1924. Look at what's happened to utilitarianism. Rashtal argues that it's no longer a single util counts for the same, no matter who enjoys it. To the contrary, he argues, and notice here his confidence that he's simply stating a conviction that everyone in England, he assumes, will consent to. Probably no one will hesitate to agree that the lower well-being of countless Chinamen or Negroes must be sacrificed, that a higher life may be possible for a much smaller number of white men. You couldn't find a more concise encapsulation of the idea of white supremacy that was used to justify slavery and Jim Crow in the United States and European imperialism worldwide. Now, of course, this system of thought in the 19th century, harshly repressive of workers and exalting capital owners, didn't last. We did see a social democratic interlude already by the mid-19th century. You see rising workers and labor movements in North America and in Europe, but they really had their heyday in the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century. The Great Depression, the two world wars, led to a spectacular decline of the rentier. This is Thomas Piketty's data for Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. You can see here, this is the ratio of capital to income. And you can see basically the top 10% or so of income drawers, mostly capital owners, right? They just collapse. The Great Depression, of course, discredited laissez-faire liberalism. And the two world wars increased state responsibility for managing the economy, for providing for the welfare of the people, massively expanded the share of revenues taken by the state, and so forth. This was true both in the United States and in Europe. And then, of course, in the post-war era, North America and Europe enjoyed about 30 years of relatively egalitarian economic growth that was built on such policies as immigration, mass public investment in education and healthcare, and so forth, a massively increased responsibility of the state. But again, to return to the introduction of my lecture, around the mid-1970s, we see the return of the 19th century liberal inversion of the relative interests of capital and labor. So my argument is that the true classical liberals favored the interests of labor over capital. Then you see in the 19th century a reversal. Then you see in the first half of the 20th century, all the way up to actually about the mid-70s, a return, ironically, under social democracy, of the original classical liberal priority of labor over capital. And then you see, starting in the mid-70s, a reversal again, back to the 19th century, in which, starting in the mid-1970s, a series of policies is adopted to dramatically favor capital interests over labor interests. And so here we can see from 1975 to 2010, this again is Piketty's data, the capital share of income is more or less rising in the rich countries of the world. There's a lot of variation between states and up and down, depending on business cycles, but you can see that the general trend is quite visible. What happened? Well, the 1970s, of course, were an era of stagflation. And in Europe, where many enterprises, particularly in the United Kingdom, were run by the state, they were not run very well. And that tended to discredit both Keynesian macroeconomics. It was read to discredit Keynesian macroeconomics as well as socialism. There was a building ideological counter-revolution, sometimes on the part of economists such as Milton Friedman and the Mount Pelerin Society, founded by Friedrich Hayek. By the fall of communism, the ideology became, there is no alternative to capitalism, understood as a set of policies that dramatically favor capital interests over labor interests. After all, communism fell. That was taken to discredit socialism more generally, even in democratic states. Supposedly, there is no alternative, the end of history, and so forth. Nevertheless, we see that this liberal inversion, with the classical liberals starting off advocating the priority of labor over capital, and the inversion found both in the 19th century during the Industrial Revolution and in the post-1970s reversal, where capital interests are favored over labor interests. In fact, that inversion leads to a bunch of contradictions. What are they? Well, essentially what happens is classical liberal arguments that were originally targeted up to the idle rich got targeted down to the working class, the precariat, the poor. And that reversal of the targets of argumentation, which carried the same verbal form as classical liberal arguments, you can see ultimately lead to contradiction. So, for instance, it's often stressed that it's important for people to earn their happiness, their welfare. And today, this idea is deployed against the welfare state. But the people who so deploy it forget that That argument applies at least as easily to people who inherit millions of dollars or pounds from their parents. Indeed, it applies at least as well to anyone who gets a major share of their income from capital. Keep in mind that income from capital ownership, from property ownership, is simply income for merely owning stuff, not for lifting one's finger and doing anything of any significance. The ideology of shareholder capitalism is equally vulnerable to this argument, since it argues for profits first at the expense of workers. But yet we never see in the neoliberal configuration any consideration that this stress on earned happiness should apply to anyone other than workers, who I thought actually were already earning their happiness. The stress on individual agency, another constant theme of neoliberal rhetoric, especially on American shores, constantly used to argue against combinations of labor. The workers should stand each individually on their own 2 feet rather than combine into labor unions. But yet that stress on individual agency is never directed against corporate capital. But what is a corporation, after all, but a combination of capital owners united under a single legal person, the corporation, same for a partnership and so forth. Somehow capital owners get to cooperate under a common legal scheme, but workers, somehow that's something wrong with that. The neoliberal stress that individuals should be responsible for the consequences of their actions, and in particular for the consequences of the contracts they sign, consistently deployed against debtors, but not against creditors. Nevertheless, creditors also, when they choose to issue loans to debtors, know that they are taking a risk, that the debtor will be unable to unpay the debt, and so attach a risk premium, increasing the interest rate that risky debtors have to pay back. So by the logic of freedom of contract, creditors should take their lickings since they already assessed the risk ahead of time and compensated themselves for them with a risk premium. But instead what we see is, as I observed before, that neoliberal policy bails out the creditors but doesn't bail out the debtors in a financial crisis. Anti-monopoly arguments are now commonly deployed against labor unions, not against the extension of intellectual property protections or against monopsony employers who now are visibly depressing wages in the United States. And the endless invocation of the need to supply incentives has different implications for workers who are provided with sticks, just as Malthus wanted, whereas capital owners only need carrots, right? Somehow there's a desperate need for more and more capital investment, so capital owners get carrots. Workers need sticks to push them back into the labor market. So in effect, what I've argued is that neoliberal policy, far from returning to classical liberalist ideas of the 17th and 18th century, are actually just bringing us back to the 19th century, reversal of classical liberalism. And indeed, what we can see here is a very famous chart on the left that displays what's known as Engels' pause. So you can see here, in the first half of the Industrial Revolution, productivity was steadily rising due to increasing better technology and increasing capital investment, but workers' wages stagnated, and they didn't start improving. Workers' wages didn't start improving and tracking rises in productivity until about the 1840s. Okay, that pause there is known as Engels' pause, and we can see the return of Engels' pause now in the American wage data on the right, with which I opened this lecture, with workers' wages stagnating, notwithstanding steadily increasing productivity. So we've actually returned to the 19th century, not to classical liberalism. And this has profound political consequences. I don't have enough time to really spell this out, but I'm happy to discuss it in Q&A. Political scientists today observe a rise in populist parties across Europe and now, of course, the United States as well, with the election of Donald Trump to the presidency. I think there's no other way to explain this rise other than to observe the fact of increasing inequality. But in addition to that, we see capital owners actually fragmenting. It's a very important development. Capital owners themselves are divided as to what they want. And some of them want populist policies like Brexit or cracking down on immigrants in the United States. Others are more globalist in orientation. And what we find with this fragmentation is that some capital owners are redeploying 19th century ideas to authoritarian ends, because populism is essentially an authoritarian type of politics. And those capital owners are appealing to people in the middle, what I'm calling national wage workers, calling them the real people, the true people, and directing their ire at their stagnating economic prospects and the fact that their children are liable to be less well off than they are, downwardly, towards underclasses who are largely racialized or conceived of as somehow different, foreign, alien, dangerous. Okay? And that's exactly the move that we see Malthus having deployed originally against, in the 19th century, against appealing to the so-called middle, the virtuous middle, against people at the bottom in order to dismantle the welfare state. In the contemporary configuration, it's deployed against immigration, okay? And it's highly racialized, both in the United States and in Europe, okay? Picking up then on the developments of utilitarian thought that were expressed by Hastings Rochtel. The important thing to keep in mind here is that although populists market themselves as in favor of the people over against elites, it's actually a subset of the elites who are telling this story to the so-called people. And that in right-wing populism, which we see dominant now in the United States and in multiple European countries, including Hungary and Poland, we see the national people, defined in racial or ethnic terms, who are deployed not just against the elites, but indeed against an underclass construed in international and quasi-racial or ethnic terms. And so on right populism, what we see is resentment against elites on the purported ground that they are unjustly favoring some racialized underclass immigrants or other sorts of minorities over the virtuous middle. So it's a kind of redeployment of the Malthusian critique of the welfare state, but now used against immigration and various cosmopolitan policies. So what lessons can we draw for today? So far, I've argued that we need to distinguish the very pro-labor 17th and 18th century version of liberalism from its 19th century version, which affected a plutocratic reversal, favoring capital over labor. I also argued that that plutocratic reversal of priorities from labor to capital, that reversal of classical liberal ideas entailed a lot of contradictions, morally speaking. Finally, in the previous slide, I argued that the actual reversal in reality of the relative interests of capital and labor has led to the rise of right populism in Europe and the United States, and that threatens both democracy and liberal rights. And indeed, it would have anyways, just an ordinary, straightforward, establishment-based plutocracy, otherwise known as undemocratic liberalism, but it also does so in its populist forms due to its exclusionary definition of the people and its rejection of the legitimacy of opposition and dissent. So that raises the question, should we just then go back to the real classical liberalism of the 17th and 18th centuries that favored labor over capital? But here we face a fundamental problem. Rising automation, artificial intelligence, it's not at all evident that the immensely advanced economies of the world need or could use all of the able-bodied people who could work if they were forced to. And that suggests to me that the technological scene has developed to a point where we need to fundamentally rethink the value of labor, where here I'm thinking of defining labor in terms of working for the market, producing for the market. We have to think that perhaps we've reached the point where technologies are so advanced that the advanced economies do not need every able-bodied person to be working for the market, producing for the market, that with a superabundance of rents generated by these immensely prosperous societies, perhaps it is time for us to think not so much about channeling income back through work, but rather sharing out the rents more equitably across everyone. So I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you.
Okay, so the floor is open. Let's start with Kave, and if other people have questions, keep your hands up.
Hi there, I'm a PhD student here in political theory at the LSE. Thank you very much for your talk. I just have a couple of questions, if I may. The first one was on neoliberalism. So I personally wasn't quite sure if you meant neoliberalism as like a policy scheme or as neoliberal thinkers, but I assume as given this a history of ideas kind of lecture, you meant the thinkers. And so it seemed to be worth mentioning that at least some neoliberal thinkers would share some of the concerns that you raise. So, of course, a little-known fact about Hayek is he was consistently critical of intellectual property in all of his works. I mean, patents, and he consistently criticized them. On anti-monopoly, in a little-known piece, Hayek had some very radical proposals to downsize corporate size. James Buchanan, of course, supported 100% inheritance tax, and even Robert Nozick, you know, was ambivalent about the distribution of wealth because he thought, on his Lockean theory, property rights have been stolen, and so on. So my first question might be, if neoliberalism means these intellectuals, right? How much is one's complaint against the policy agenda, and how much of it is what these guys were pushing? And then just secondly, if I may, so your talk seems to be focused mostly on the rise of inequality in liberal democratic states. Of course, as many on the left have observed, if you look at equality on a global basis, with the rise of not just China but other countries, I mean, it's been a boon for egalitarianism insofar as and the expansion of markets has helped many people in countries like China to enter the middle class. And to the extent that it's easy to run a golden age of capitalism, I think, when China and the Soviet Union, are scoped out of markets, it seems to me that we face a trade-off. And I think the pushback would be, well, if you have even mild cosmopolitan leanings, right, so we're not just nationally focused, well, it seems pretty good, right? So, I mean, if we're worried about labor globally, right, it's been an egalitarian.
So we have two questions at the table.
So that was
one is
that was the question. Yeah.
To be sure, you can find particular neoliberal figures and particular policies that look pretty authentic from a classical liberal point of view, but I think the overall thrust of their views is strongly in favor of the bulk of the policies. You can find minor exceptions here and there, which were overwhelmingly ignored by policymakers. So, for instance, in the United States, Nozick made a famous argument that taxation is theft, with a small qualifier. If you read very closely in Anarchy, State, and Utopia, he limited the scope of the taxation is theft argument to taxation of labor income. But as it's deployed in the United States today, it's overwhelmingly used to defend the right of inheritance and people being able to, you know, take home capital gains at minimal taxation and so forth. So I think, yes, you can find these minor deviations in some of the thinkers, but by and large, they have supported the bulk of neoliberal policies adopted since the mid-1970s. As far as globalization goes, I'm actually a fan of globalization. There's nothing that I've said in my talk that opposes this. I do think, though, that the international global regime should be used to ratchet up labor standards. It is true that you can find, say, about 300 million Chinese that moved from poverty to middle-class status, but they did so on the backs of extremely highly exploited workers in the factories. There's no reason why the global trading regime should tolerate that kind of exploitation. All the workers should be able to profit from the global trading regime, and that requires a fundamental reshifting, I think, of the relative power of capital and labor.
Thank you for your lecture, which I enjoyed very much. I agree with 90% of what you said. The point where I possibly disagree with you is that I think one of the reasons for populism is the fact that actually all workers of all races have actually become relatively impoverished. Wages have stagnated across the board. And I'm sort of kind of asking, how can one get a narrative that explains to maybe the white working class that the enemy isn't necessarily black workers or minority workers or whatever. It's actually the whole system. And I think that your analysis tends to sort of blame workers for sort of, you know, falling into the trap of populism of, you know. So I wondered if you have a way of getting around that.
Right. So what I think has happened, if you talk to the political scientists, and here I'm just deferring to their expertise, public opinion tends to be strongly elite-driven. And so what we see is, you know, Murdoch here in the UK and various right-wing media such as Breitbart and Fox News over in the United States and other right-wing media in the other right populist countries have been telling a narrative that white working classes find highly compelling because it already fits in to pre-existing xenophobia, racism of various sorts. And so what I think is desperately needed now is an alternative narrative advanced by social democrats that explains that the source of rising inequality isn't the immigrants or, in the United States, African Americans, but in fact it's the global system of roles that systematically favors capital interests over labor interests. I do think there's empirical evidence that the white working classes of these countries can be persuaded, but it requires effective articulation of an alternative narrative.
Just here, third row here, sorry.
Thank you for your lecture. So I guess I'm interested to know whether you think the neoliberal inversion of classical liberal thinkers is reflected in contemporary liberal political theory in the kind of professional academic realm rather than the kind of public political discourse that you've been talking about. And also, I suppose, what hopes you have for the possibility of political theorists contributing to developing that alternative narrative?
So, yes, yeah, so I do think that there's been a lot of bad economic theory that has pushed along neoliberal ideas. There's a huge industry, some of it very generously paid for by billionaires, in producing papers that supposedly show that the optimal rate of taxation for capital income is zero, for instance. So, yeah, I do think that to a certain degree, academics are responsible for the problem. And I think that then makes academics responsible not just for publishing articles in journals where they do all the proper scholarship with a million footnotes, but to speak to the public and offer an alternative vision.
Yeah, shall I go? Sorry. Thank you for your talk. I found the distinction you've drawn between 17th, 18th, and 19th really persuasive, and actually, as a social sciences graduate, new. I've not heard the distinction drawn in that way before. So my question to you is, if you talk about the way you sort of turned Adam Smith on his head, and you used his writings to undermine what we now call neoliberalism. It's not just the newspapers that are getting that wrong. And you've said it yourself in the previous answer, academics are responsible for that misinformation. So my question to you is, why is that the case? Why are social science undergraduates taught that Adam Smith is someone that he isn't? Why are those passages that you referenced in this lecture overlooked by academics, by your academic colleagues?
That's a really great question. I could, by the way, give you dozens and dozens more quotes from The Wealth of Nations. Adam Smith was a true champion of ordinary workers. And in fact, this has been known by Smith scholars for decades now. So I'm not even giving you anything new that Smith scholars don't know. But what you do see is a lot of professors hate to revise their lecture notes. Right? They just pull out the same thing they've been given, you know, for decades. They haven't really kept up with the latest scholarship. But in particular, what we do know was that Smith, who was well understood at the time, you know, Smith was a hero of the French Revolution. Okay? People knew at the time he was writing that he was very much an egalitarian and in favor of the workers. But in England in particular, as you know, there was a sharp reaction against the French Revolution and a kind of panic over that, and hence a desperate need to reread reinterpret their hero, Adam Smith, as on the other side. And that, of course, fell conveniently with the interests of capital owners rising in the 19th century. So, in fact, what we see is a massive misappropriation of Smith during the 19th century, and then by habit, because nobody bothered to pick up this, you know, what is it, 600-page tome, The Wealth of Nations, and really start reading the passages carefully. How many people do that? that narrative just sort of continued, and Smith scholars know that the 19th century misappropriation of Smith is totally misleading. But all the textbooks, they've been saying this for ages and so forth. If you don't go back to the primary text, you'll never discover it.
Let's take two questions together. So there's one down very back here in the middle.
Thank you. I just had a question about what you said at the end of your presentation, and I wanted to hear you clarify what you meant by economy swimming in rents and rent-seeking behavior. So at least the way that I use the term, it kind of means something like, rather than competing on increasing the quality or lowering the price of your good and service, what you try to do is kind of rig the game towards your favor. And so through political means or something like that. And when you said something like distributing the gains of rent-seeking behavior, it sounded like what you're saying is, you know, there's some corruption, and what we should do is distribute the gains of corruption a little bit more fairly. I don't think that that's what you, I mean, you know, it had you had more time, I don't know if that's what you meant, but I just wanted to hear more about what you meant by rent seeking behavior.
Right, so let me just clear. Oh, okay, just one more. Yeah, okay.
I'm sorry, my English is not so well, I'm Italian. But a lot of study now speaks about inequity and the diversity between rich and poor. So you, Piketty, all on Italy also we have the problem. We became Europe, we became like America. And about speaking about working class, no one do it anymore because it's not very popular. Do you think that a network of like you, professor, academic, and people who study, can change a little bit the policy in the world? Because what you said is true, and the working class doesn't exist anymore. The union doesn't have any power anymore. So the workers are alone, and they cannot change or fight against the capitalism law. So do you have an international network about with other academics like you?
Okay, so first, just about what rents mean in this case, I'm not referring to rent-seeking behavior, but just the existence of lots and lots of income that isn't attributable to work. Okay, and it's just practically inevitable. Look, every rich country is sitting on masses of technology that were developed by prior laborers, okay, and we're reaping the fruits of that incredibly high productivity due to past workers, but not present workers, okay? And so a lot of that productivity is generating immense amounts of wealth, okay? And that's all I mean by rents, right? It's just all kinds of income that's generated without having to work for it, okay? And that's like a great blessing of advanced technological societies, okay? And then with respect to the question of, you know, what can intellectuals do about this, I am not a materialist with respect to history. Ideas matter. Ideas make a difference to the direction of human history. And that's why academics and other ideas people have a responsibility to articulate alternative ideas. Remember the incredible power of that 1989 thought after the fall of communism that there is no alternative. That operates to shut down people's political imaginations to imagine a better world. And what do academics and other ideas people do? They talk about how things could be different. This is one of the reasons why I urge people to study history, right? Because what you find if you study the history of political thought is a spectacular variety of ideas people have had about how to organize society, production, trade, and so forth. There's way more ideas out there. Many of them have been long forgotten. And indeed, as I argued in this lecture, some of the ideas which we have inherited from the 19th century are not only dubious, but quite oppressive and nasty, and we're living those ideas today. Surely in an advanced technological society, we can think of better ways to live.
One question here in the middle.
Hi, thank you for the rewarding lecture. I just had a quick question about your discussion of populism. If memory serves, in the slide you introduce populism as a theme and then clarify when talking about right populism. Could you speak more about left populism?
The right. Populism? Okay, so again...
One more.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. I agree with most of what you said. Just like to pick up on the idea that original liberalism was against all forms of unfree labour. If we look at the fifth chapter of the Second Treatise by Locke, he talks about the turfs, my servant has cut, and mine. They don't belong to the actual person who's laboured to produce them. And also that labour gives a title in initial acquisition. But then Locke kicks away all these limitations on capital accumulation. And given different talents, this implies an inequality in property ownership and therefore a minority ruling class. And a majority working class are exploited given the unlimited nature of property accumulation then. And also the idea that Locke never intended ordinary labouring people to have property or to be able to vote. So in that case, I'd just like to draw attention to that.
Oh, yeah. So I'm completely aware of this, but I think actually... what you're giving me is C.B. McPherson's reading of Locke. Okay, he was a Marxist and he wanted to project sort of capitalist ideas back onto the 17th century. I don't think actually that's accurate. I recommend that you take a look at a wonderful article by Jacqueline Stevens. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was published in Political Theory a number of years ago. Something like... the rationality of Locke's majoritarianism or something like this, in which she argues that Locke's actual view was that majorities rule. They can reconfigure property, the rules of property, pretty much however they like, subject to the constraint that nobody starve as a result or be driven to utter destitution. And she also gives a very compelling argument that the people who were called servants in Locke's day were mostly young adults. So he favored, on her argument, universal franchise just with a high starting age, maybe around 30, for men, of course. Locke was a good feminist, but he hadn't gone so far as to think about enfranchising women, at least not explicitly, although I think the inner logic of his argument would entail the enfranchisement of women as well. So I recommend you take a look at Stevens, who I think gives us a radically different and I think historically more accurate interpretation of what Locke is about. Now, turning to the question of left versus right populism, again, I'm borrowing the terminology from political scientists, people like Jan Werner Müller, who argue that populism, whether left or right, always advocates an exclusive definition of who the people are over against elites. Okay, the left-wing version has a two-class theory. The right-wing version has a three-class theory. So what I showed you is the right-wing version, which tends to be dominant in the United States and in Europe. So they're the virtuous middle people who are the the ethnic nation, the dominant ethnic group within the nation, feels itself betrayed by elites because elites are supposedly favoring various foreign, other raced, other ethnicity individuals over them. Okay, that's a three-class story. The left-wing version of populism is a two-class story. The elites are just trampling on the virtuous people who are workers. That's what you see manifest in Venezuela, probably the most notorious case of left populism today, bringing its country actively to ruin. Populism, whatever its forms, because it advocates an exclusive and narrow definition of who the people are and rejects the legitimacy of opposition, is inherently both opposed to liberal rights and to democracy.
We'll take two more questions, one there and one here. And one here, three.
Oh, sorry. Hi, thank you for your talk. I had a quick question at the end. You mentioned emerging disruptive technologies such as AI, and I was wondering what impact you thought they were going to have on our society more broadly, and as well as the analysis that you've just given of liberalism broken down by sort of capital and labor.
Thank you for this, and I really enjoyed it, especially your discussion about the importance of studying the history of political thought as a kind of, you know, as a history of ways of thinking differently and imagining how things might be different. I just have to sort of, I think that you're right that the McPherson reading of Locke has a lot to answer for, and not just of Locke, but of the levelers. So I think there's a kind of story here about a kind of Marxist or neo-Marxist historiography about early modern English intellectual history. But just to say, I think I'm going to have to push back on Locke being a good feminist, just because I think we do have to take seriously his notes and epistles on, his paraphrase and notes on the epistles of St. Paul, where he talks about the natural inferiority of women. So.
A good feminist for his day.
Okay. One more here, last question.
Thank you as well. My question also refers to the populism area, and I was wondering what you think about those theoretical approaches that try to explain populism not only by referring to the 19th century plutocratic reversal, but who actually explain it by referring to liberalism as such. I'm thinking of the arguments by Chantal Mouffe, for example, saying that too much focus on rationality and on negative freedom instead of positive freedom lead to populism more than actually the gap in income. Thank you. What do you think of this?
So I guess, you know, with respect to populism, I'm not really persuaded by that argument. I think it's the stagnation of the prospects of the so-called the dominant national groups within the states that is fundamental to populist politics. It's being exploited by turning resentment down to various underclasses, immigrants, racialized others, and so forth. And I don't think negative freedom, I don't think that really has a lot to do with it. Getting back to the question of the implications of automation, look, I think it's coming. 30 million workers in the United States drive for a living, trucks or Uber, taxis, and so forth. Okay, those jobs are probably going to disappear. Will capitalism come up with replacement jobs? That's not at all evident. Should we deplore that fact? Well, that all depends on how the income generated from artificial intelligence and other advanced technologies gets distributed. People have a lot of other meaningful things to do with their time than laboring for the market. And if they had access to income from capital, then they'd be able to do lots of other useful and meaningful work, but not for a wage. just meaningful activity, we should say, rather than work. I don't think that we should predict that people will just be lying in a hammock all day. They have lots of interesting things to do with their lives and could use some capital income to free them up to do it.
Okay, please join me in thanking Elizabeth Anderson.